I'll call to order the Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is Monday, February 28th, 2011, and we are convened for the purposes of introducing the committee measure, which we will do shortly, and also providing a public hearing and possible work session on a number of bills. For those of you who might be waiting on some of these bills, let me update the agenda for you briefly. First of all, the work session for Senate Bill 14 is not going to be happening today. We're not going to take any further action on Senate Bill 14 today, and we'll most likely roll this over till Wednesday, or reschedule it, depending. We are also not going to hear Senate Bill 34, so if anyone is here on Senate Bill 34, feel free to go about your day. So what we're going to do, since we have a distinguished member of the House of Representatives in our midst, we will hear Senate Bill 494 first, and then go to SCR 2, SB 30, SB 35, and SB 292, and then we will conclude. So why don't I start with the introduction of committee measures.
Do I need to open the work session
yes,
to do that?
I'd like to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures. Senator Monroe?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that the committee introduce LC 3949 as a committee bill with the vote having no say as to whether or not individuals support it.
Thank you, Senator Monroe, and particularly for the caveat. Senator Monroe moves LC 3949, dated 2/24/11, be introduced as a committee bill. And again, colleagues, this doesn't indicate that you support or oppose this bill. It's just bringing it into the process. Is there any discussion?
Other than I don't have a clue what it is, so I don't oppose or support.
We probably got it to
it
your email accounts.
It was sent.
It is the bill relating to.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Then I might have to take a position.
Okay. I see nothing. All right. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, it is adopted. I will then open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 494. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 494 removes the sunset on provisions related to business development loans and entrepreneurial development loans. It removes the requirement that a small business enterprise be certified as an emerging small business enterprise in order to qualify for a loan from the Business Development Fund. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon signature by the governor. You also have you've been sent in your packet the Dash 1 amendment. That's the amendment that I believe the sponsors and the agency are interested in having going forward. They'll speak to that, I'm sure. But in your packets, you'll also see, and I just put on your desk, the fiscal impact statement for the bill as amended by the Dash 1 amendments. It does have an other funds impact of $129,845. And as a result, the legislative fiscal office has requested that this measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means if the committee takes action on this measure, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Patrick. Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Chair Shields and Vice Chair George and committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici, Senate District 17, and I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for scheduling this hearing and possible work session. Senate Bill 494. This Senate bill builds on the success of the Access to Business Capital Act, which was passed in 2010 under Senate Bill 1017, and Representative Doherty and I sponsored that act with the support of many of you here today and many of our colleagues in order to increase the amount of capital available to small and emerging businesses in Oregon during a time of economic crisis and when credit has been difficult to secure. The Access to Business Capital Act provides Business Oregon, our state's economic development agency, more flexibility in administering two important programs, the Oregon Business Development Fund, which is a revolving loan fund, and the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, which is to help microenterprise and small businesses and fill a niche not provided through traditional lending markets. Changes made to those two funds in Senate Bill 1017 have broadened the pool of eligible applicants for loan consideration The changes also expedited Business Oregon's loan approval and processing time, which has dramatically reduced the closing time for loans and getting capital into the hands of small businesses. It's provided Business Oregon the ability to fill a larger financing gap per project to respond to the tighter lending criteria that's been imposed. And specifically since Senate Bill 1017 was signed into law, the Access to Business Capital Act has helped many small Oregon businesses thrive in the following ways that Representative Doherty is going to tell you about.
Okay, thank you very much. I am Representative Margaret Doherty. I represent House District 35 in the Greater Tigard area. Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee. As Senator Bonamici said, that since last April, when the act was actually put into practice, loans have been made to small businesses in cities across the state. And it was so important to get capital out to people that that was the whole purpose. Many of the cities that have benefited businesses have been from Coos Bay, John Day, Portland, Eugene, Albany, Hood River, Baker City, and Medford. And for example, Ninkasi Brewing in Eugene obtained a loan to expand their bottling line, and they plan to create at least 17 new jobs. Frog Eyes Wasabi in Pacific City was able to finance a new greenhouse, helping to obtain retain two jobs. Ochoco Lumber and John Day created 11 new jobs through the construction of a new pellet facility. And Rogue Trucking Body received a loan helping them to stay in business and create and retain 11 jobs. More than $5 million in loans have been made to Oregon companies, and these funds have leveraged more than $50 million in additional private sector project financing. There are more than 10 potential projects in the pipeline to include loans from small businesses in Salem, Bend, and Klamath Falls. But more importantly, these small business loans have helped create and retain nearly 300 jobs across Oregon.
So, Senator Shields, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and Committee, Senate Bill 494 with a dash one amendment clarifies the part of the Access to Business Capital Act that sets aside a portion of the funds for emerging small businesses in rural and distressed areas in Oregon. We do support the dash one amendment. It clarifies a 15% set aside, but it also allows for flexibility in non-traded sector companies in rural and distressed areas if Business Oregon does not receive a sufficient number of approvable applications. So it does, the dash one amendment gives Business Oregon more flexibility in using those set aside funds. The Access to Business Capital Act has been successful in creating and retaining family wage jobs during a time of economic stress in Oregon by removing the sunset date and by making other small changes to the Access to Business Capital Act. Senate Bill 494 will give Business Oregon powerful tools to help businesses and the people they employ thrive. I urge the committee to send Senate Bill 494 with a dash one amendment. I believe you said it did need to go to Ways and Means and then hopefully to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I would be happy to answer any questions, and I know Representative Doherty would as well, but we do have in the room, I believe both Paul Grove and John Saris from Business Oregon are here in case you have hard questions.
Hard questions, technical questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I actually would have one for the agency if one of them could come up.
Okay.
I have a hard question.
They're both here. Right. Terrific. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee. Could you tell me if North and Northeast Portland is considered a distressed area for the purposes of this bill?
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris, and I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. To answer your question, at this time, there really is only one county that has non-distressed areas in it, and I believe it's Gillam County. So the entirety of the rest of the state at this time is a distressed area.
That's interesting. So things are great in Gillam County.
Yeah, what do they got going on? I have two questions.
Garbage.
Wind farms.
We have those garbage climate.
That's true.
Contract.
That's right. The Russian wheat crisis helped.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Senator Bocas.
I'm just, help me understand the LFO's fiscal here. I'm assuming the $120,845 is the cost of one position to be extended into correctuality here or something?
Yeah. Chair, Vice Chair, Senator Boquist. That position would become a single, one full-time FTE that would become a permanent position, and it is funded through the interest income that the program and fee income that the program generates, so it wouldn't have a direct impact to either general or lottery funds.
Follow up question, Mr. Chair. Just make sure we're retaining the existing person you have now is what we're saying here, right?
Correct.
If the fund goes on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All right. So we first have to move the dash one. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, was anybody here else to testify on this? Okay. I will open close the public hearing on Senate Bill 494 and open a work session on Senate Bill 494.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 494.
Senator George has moved the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 494. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 494 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 494 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Well, Debbie, why don't you call the roll on this, please?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator
Yes, ma'am.
Monroe?
Yes, and we'll take good care of it down in Ways and Means.
Senator George?
Aye.
Aye. The measure passes. This is on its way to Ways and Means. I remember when I was on Ways and Means, people would actually come to my subcommittee and ask me, would request a hearing on these bills, and I had to tell them I don't really have that kind of power.
That's right.
So if you want to go down and lobby the Ways and Means subcommittee, feel free, but probably use your time in other pursuits.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Bonamici and Representative Doherty, for bringing this forward and to the department for your great work. I will open a public hearing and possible work session on SCR 2. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Concurrent Resolution 2 designates the Happy Canyon Indian Pageant and Wild West Show as Oregon's official outdoor pageant and Wild West Show. You'll note, I believe I've sent the materials electronically via the shared drive on Friday, that there is no fiscal or revenue impact to the measure.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for coming all this way.
Yes, my name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, which is the four northeast counties of Northeast Oregon, Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. I have today with Jason Hill, who is one of the directors. I don't know, he's president or director?
Show director.
Show director. He's the show director of the Happy Canyon. And this, Jason came to me about 6 months ago and said, well, you know, this was the 100th year of the Pendleton Roundup anniversary, and there was a lot of activity. And part of the situation they're looking at is they're looking at marketing devices, and they're looking at, they could declare this show as the state outdoor western pageant.
Indian Pageant Wild West Show.
Indian Pageant Wild West Show. That would really be a great help to them and giving them a boost up. And so I introduce Jason. If you want to introduce some of the fellows in the back of the room, you also have two of the princesses from the Happy Canyon here who are in their dress outfits.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Hill. I'm here from Pendleton, Oregon at the Happy Canyon Night Show. I'm here today to testify in support of Concurrent Resolution Number 2. Thank you for allowing us to be here. We're excited and honored. I want to introduce the 2011 Happy Canyon Princesses, Michaela McKay and Chelsea Minthorn, our current Vice President, Bob Rozelle, and our outgoing President, Alan Wagner, and his wife, Becky.
Thanks for coming all this way. Welcome to your legislature.
I want to point out how long that these people have been involved in Happy Canyon. I'll start with the Happy Canyon Princesses. Both these young ladies will represent Happy Canyon for the next 7 months and attend different events all over the Pacific Northwest. Their families have been involved in Happy Canyon for many years. Chelsea's grandmother, Caroline, was Happy Canyon's first princess in 1955, and she is still involved with the show today. Bob Rozelle has had 27 years in the show. He was elected to the board in 2004 and now is the current vice president. Alan Wagner has been with the show for 23 years, elected to the board in 2002, and president in 2009 and 2010. And Becky and I started in the show together. She's been a cast member since 1970, and Alan and Becky's children are also on the show, making them sixth-generation cast members. When I asked them if they'd come to Salem with me to make this presentation to you, they all said yes without hesitation. It's not because they owe me favors. It's because they're dedicated lifetime volunteers to Happy Canyon. They exemplify many of the cast members' families that have years and years of service to Happy Canyon. This is what Happy Canyon is: a true spirit of community. It is generational volunteerism and it's family tradition. I've been on the board since 2006, current show director. Like many of the people involved today, I started the show when I was 5 years old. Over the years, I've taken for granted the level of volunteerism that makes this show happen. It's always been something you just do, and this is without a doubt what has kept Happy Canyon going for all of these 95 years. You cannot have an event like this, of this size, function like it does without volunteers that are not willing to do whatever it takes for the show to go on. The Happy Canyon Night Show is the core event for the evening activities during Roundup Week in Pendleton. With its historically based storyline for the first half of the show, it depicts the interaction of Lewis and Clark and the white settlers with the local tribes, to the slapstick second half of the show, with most of its parts originally written in 1914. They're still being performed today. There's heavy tribal and community involvement. This show has gone on every year since 1916, except during two years of World War II. This show goes on without fail, rain or shine, period. This makes it a true Oregon icon. By any standard, this is unheard of for any event anywhere in the United States. I'm energized about this because as a show director, I have the best seat in the house. I'm right down in front. I'm inches away and eye level with everything that happens on the set. I know how much work goes into the show and the level of ownership that the cast and crew take in their parts. The grounds crew and the lighting crew start working in May. Volunteers show up Roundup Week using vacation time or by whatever means necessary to come and work or perform for no pay other than to be part of the action. The directors work throughout the year on things that will come together for the second week in September, and this is why it is so unique and so special. This is also what should be known by everyone in Oregon and celebrated. This is true spirit of the West, and I'm very proud of our show, and Oregon should be very proud as well. Happy Canyon is just a few short years away from celebrating our 100th anniversary. My wish and the wish of everyone involved with Happy Canyon is that it keeps on track and heads into the future for many years to come. This resolution would honor the people that make this show a reality. It would recognize their labor and love, and most of all, their long-term dedication. It would recognize the longevity of our show. It would acknowledge the people that conceived the idea in 1913. This achievement deserves to be honored as Oregon's official outdoor pageant and Wild West show. And I want to thank Dave and Alice Nelson for all the time and effort they put into this. This is not my forte, so they helped me right along with this. And thank you again for allowing us to be here today, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, and I would like to acknowledge Alice Nelson, who I'm sure did all the work on this. Yeah, any questions?
Well, this is a good pass. Can we get wolves in this somehow?
Senator George. Last time one of these types of bills came before a committee I was on, we were designating who would be the Ice Age location. We thought it was a great idea, and come to find out there was somebody else who had an Ice Age museum that they wanted to do, so I got in trouble because there's two different competing. I want to make sure that my folks over in Shampooey are not an outdoor pageant, and they're going to be mad. So did anybody check with the folks at Shampooey or any of those types of outdoor pageant?
Well, we checked like with Shakespeare, things of that nature, and as far as in conjunction with the rodeo, being a night show of a rodeo, I don't think there's anything.
This show is so unique, I don't think you could compare it really to anything else.
You have the tribal participation, and this truly is a unique show. I didn't think about Shampooey.
I still want to get in trouble with folks in my district.
Are they 95 years old?
They've been around for a long time. I don't know. Okay. I guess I would say is it when I look at the Mr. Chair, when I read it, it's Outdoor Pageant and Wild West. It's all one clause. So we'll just call it with the Wild West show. It's different than anything Shampooey would do.
Yeah, if
that makes sense to everybody, then I'm fine.
Yeah, we looked at that. We looked at that language pretty closely, and Jason and went over to the board of directors. You went over it pretty carefully.
I'm comfortable with it.
Because one of the things I did say is that I was sure that there was going to be somebody who's going to ask the question. You know, does this really affect? Or is anybody else that has this same type of program? And the only one I could think of was a Shakespeare, but that's not a Wild West. It's not an Indian pageant. It's something else. Well, some people think it's a Wild West, I guess.
Senator Boquist.
Senator George, Shampooey started out as a meeting to shoot wolves, and we could never get that through this legislature. So you don't need to worry about yours.
You might also know that, a personal thing, the Happy Canyon was one of the first jobs I had outside the farm, and I got paid for it because my dad would never pay me. But they would pay in silver dollars in those days, and I got to usher. But the big thing was I got to go to the dance afterwards.
Wow.
So it's a big thing for me. So I appreciate your help and support.
Did you go on covered wagon?
No, I wasn't. No, these guys are all...
Sorry.
Thank you. Any more questions?
No, it was a Surrey with a fringe on top.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. Would anybody else like to testify on SCR 2?
All right.
We will close the public hearing on SCR 2, and ready to go with that. And let's open the a work session on SCR 2. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves SCR 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. No chance to turn back now, Senator George?
I know, I'm walking the plank. But I raise the issue. That's all that matters.
Is there any discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Yes.
And Chair Shields?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Nelson, would you like to carry this on the floor? Put Senator Nelson down as a carrier. Thank you all very much for coming all this way. We sure do appreciate it. Thanks for your work bringing dollars into the good state of Oregon. We'll close the public hearing on SCR 2, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 30. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 30 requires that endowment care cemeteries deposit into an endowment care fund at least 9% of the gross sales price of graves that are sold with grave liners installed at the time of sale. It clarifies that an endowment care cemetery may deposit more than the required amount percentage of the sales price into the endowment care fund. This measure has no fiscal, and just received right before committee started, no fiscal or revenue impact, so all of the paperwork necessary is in hand, Mr. Chair.
All right. Let's see. Senator Monroe, would you like to testify from here?
Well, I'd just like to introduce Mr. Farrell.
Okay.
And I think he brought somebody with him. This is Tim Farrell of Hood River, and I introduced this bill at his request, and he will tell you all about it.
Mr. Farrell, would you like to come forward? And Mr. Noble, would you like to come forward as well?
Yes. Okay. Tim Farrell on behalf of the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I'm its current secretary.
Dead people.
And David Noble is very knowledgeable on these matters. So if you can introduce yourself, sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman Shields, Vice Chair George, committee members. My name is David Noble. I'm the executive director of Riverview Cemetery in Southwest Portland. I also own two small rural historic cemeteries in Lane County, which after the recent testimony, I'm wishing was in Gillum County, since they're the only ones in the world that aren't distressed. But happy to take a moment to testify about this bill, and thank you for entertaining it. I have a handout that's given to the clerk, and I won't read it for you, but basically
The Cemetery Association of Oregon, of which I'm a member and have been involved with for many years, which is about 35 to 40 the major cemeteries in Oregon, believes that we just need to do kind of some housekeeping to ORS 97, which is the major statute that governs cemetery law in Oregon, including the amount of money that should be deposited into endowment cure cemeteries. Things have changed somewhat in the business over hundreds of years, and larger cemeteries are now creating what we often call a lawn crypt, where when they develop a section, they actually pre-inter all the outer burial containers or grave liners, and then they sell that as a package rather than separately. And there's the statute is really silent as to then how much money should be put into endowment care. So to give cemeteries some guidelines and to give DCBS, which is the agency that oversees endowment care fund matters, the association is introducing this bill suggesting that that amount be 9%. Now, just so you have an idea of where that percentage came from, a grave with no outer burial container in it would be 15%. We looked around at pricing of graves with or without outer burial containers pre-interred and found that generally a grave without was about 60% of compared to the price of some cemetery that had graves that were pre-interred liners. We also checked with other states around the country that have done legislation in the last few years to address this matter, and most of them were coming in around 8 or 9%. So that seemed like the appropriate number. Without any change to the existing statute, it's really kind of up to cemeteries to arbitrarily decide how much value they want to put on the grave itself and how much value they want to put on the outer burial container, which could create the temptation to under-contribute to the endowment fund. And we want cemeteries to be in good condition for a long term, so we like to see something in the statute that creates a standard. Now, the other part of this bill is just some language that adds the word at least in a bunch of places, and that's so that there's no question that cemeteries that wish to can contribute more. And the cemetery that I manage in Portland, for example, we're a nonprofit. We don't have any shareholders to pay. We actually contribute double the required amount. Again, trying to be forward-thinking and making sure that someday down the road when the cemetery is full, the endowment fund will have enough money to generate revenue to take care of the cemetery. And unless there's any questions, that's my testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Noble.
The only thing I have to add is that as you may recall from my testimony at SB 29, is that I run a historic cemetery in Hood River County. And I guess we stand...
Excuse me, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Tim Farrell from the Cemetery Association of Oregon in Hood River, Oregon. And I guess we stand to testify, if you will, or as witnesses, that we need to make sure that some reasonable amount is put into the endowment cares of all cemeteries for the decades and, you know, centuries to come. And the Cemetery Association and Mr. Noble and others have looked into this, and this seems to be a reasonable amount that will accomplish that. So with that, we support this legislation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Senator Monroe.
Yes, I'm sure you heard that Senate Bill 29 passed unanimously this morning. Hope we have as good luck with this one. Makes sense. The 60% of 15 is 9. So it makes sense that that's where you came up with that number. And it does make sense. And that is a minimum now, right?
Correct.
So any cemetery association that wanted to reserve greater than that amount could do so. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Monroe. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 30? All right. Seeing none, do we have a fiscal back from this, Patrick?
We do, sir.
And it is minimal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there it's a no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair. So.
All right, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 30 and open a work session on Senate Bill 30.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 30 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 30 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Berkowitz?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Monroe, would you like to carry it?
I would be more than pleased.
Senator Monroe will be the carrier, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 30.
Now we're going to have to
And we're going to skip over Senate Bill 34 indefinitely. And colleagues, I will then open a public hearing on Senate Bill 35. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 35. Removes disqualifications for unemployment insurance benefits for services other than instructional, research, or principal administrative services that are performed at educational institutions. It codifies the presumption that part-time instructors at state institutions of higher education or community colleges do not have reasonable assurance of performing the same services for the institution or community college during the following term. You have in your packets the notice of no revenue impact for this, but we have not received as of yet the fiscal impact statement, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we're not ready to move this today. Hopefully we'll set a work session for this in the near future, if that's the intention of the committee. So, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Luisi. I live in Hermiston, Oregon. I'm the president of the Oregon School Employees Association, OSEA, AFT Local 6732. OSEA represents over 20,000 education staff and public service employees working in Oregon's kindergarten through 12th grade schools, education and service districts, community colleges, Head Start agencies, libraries, and park and recs. In addition to being the OSEA president, I'm also the program secretary for the special ed department in the Hermiston School District. I've worked in that district for 21 years. During those years, I've heard many stories from my coworkers who are classified staff about the economic hardships they endure during school closure periods, especially the summer months. These hardships could have been minimized if these hourly employees had been eligible for unemployment benefits. Merlene Martin, the past president of OSEA, and Everest Murrow, the OSEA secretary, have joined me today and will share with the committee some of our members' stories. I'm here today on behalf of all OSEA members to encourage this committee to support Senate Bill 35, which would allow classified staff employed by school districts to be eligible for unemployment compensation during school closures. In 1992, federal legislation was passed allowing states to once again provide unemployment compensation to classified education employees during an academic year and term closure periods. That legislation reversed an amendment to the Social Security Act that was passed in 1983. Since 1993, OSEA has requested and urged legislators to support the amendments to the current Oregon law as contained in Senate Bill 35. If enacted, it would extend the economic safety net available to nearly every other public and private sector hourly worker in Oregon to classified school employees. We all know how important unemployment benefits are to working Oregonians. The need is never so widely felt as it is during an economic recession. During this current Great Recession in Oregon and nationally, millions of working men and women have depended on unemployment benefits to put food on the table, pay rent, to keep a roof over their heads, try to keep up with all the bills, and at the same time, actively seek employment. The hardships are no different for classified school employees. However, for classified school employees, there is a recession every summer. Every year, members of my union search for scarce part-time jobs during the summer months. Many never find that job. Each year, I hear stories from our members who are forced to make choices between putting food on the table and paying their rent during school closure times. The need for unemployment insurance is real among our employees. Our members seek their exclusion from unemployment insurance benefits during the school closures as discriminatory, and nothing shows that more than the fact that private sector employees working in our public schools, doing the same work as the classified district employees, are eligible for unemployment benefits during school closures. Our members know firsthand that Oregon is facing a severe local and state funding crisis. And some of you may say that even requesting and supporting a bill like Senate Bill 35 is absurd, given the funding cuts being discussed in this session. It has been 19 years since the federal legislation was passed allowing states to recognize classified educational staff as eligible for unemployment. During that time, Oregon's economy has been both good and bad. Our response during good and bad time has been the same. Let us recognize that there is a problem and find solutions. There is a problem, and OSEA is committed to finding solutions that make Senate Bill 35 a reality. I urge the committee to work with us in support of Senate Bill 35. Now, before my two witnesses speak, I'd like to just say that I have someone in my own chapter in Hermiston that had written a letter in, and I'll just kind of summarize what she said. Is she was hired to work with the Start Making a Reader Today program, which was a paid position. It went to a volunteer position, so she lost her job. She was eventually hired back on as a Title I assistant in the Hermiston School District. 2 weeks later, her husband lost his job. He's on unemployment. He got another job because the recession lost that job. They are now going into the year-end stretch where summer's coming up and on unemployment and nothing in the summer, but his unemployment is going to be real tough for them. And she specifically asked that we really look into this and see what we can do. Thank you. Marlene?
Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Marlene Martin, and I am the past president of the Oregon School Employees Association, and I reside at 386 Talamina Drive in the beautiful bottleneck of the Willamette Valley, Cottage Grove, Oregon. I'm joining President Luisi and Secretary Morrow today in support of Senate Bill 35. So what I want to do is share another story with you, and I'm going to read that directly so that, to make sure that I give it the justice that the member that wrote it had. And I have submitted it in my testimony also. So last week, OSEA sent out a special request to our members, and we asked them for their stories on the impact of not being eligible for unemployment benefits during school closures. The response from our members have been steady ever since that notice went out, you can well imagine. Some of these stories express frustration, and others simply tell the story of the hardships faced every year during school closure periods, hardships that would be minimized if Senate Bill 35 were enacted. And my story is from Paulette Parker, and she works in the Dallas School District. And like I said, I am going to read it word for word. I have worked as a classified employee in the Dallas School District for almost 11 years. I have been a single mom all of those years, and it has been impossible to make ends meet year-round on just 9 months of work. I have tried to get summer work, but I've been unsuccessful. It seems that employers don't want to hire someone for short times. Also, there is a lot of competition for jobs from college students. The summer months are far from the busy holiday season, so merchants are not really looking for extra help anyway. At the end of every school year, we sign an intent to return form, which does not guarantee nor promise a position with the school district. It only seems to make sure that we intend to return if they want us back and deny any chance of us qualifying for unemployment insurance when in fact we are unemployed for 3 months. Unfortunately, the lack of sufficient employment does not just affect us during the summer months. Things don't just magically get better in September. Each year, after 3 months of unemployment, we are further behind than before. I am embarrassed to admit that I have had to resort to using credit cards to fill in the lack of summer employment. Imagine this having to go on every year, 11 summers so far. Financially, this has taken a toll on my family, and the stress is continual throughout the school year, too, as I tried to financially catch up. It would have been and would be very helpful if we, as classified employees, were able to access unemployment insurance during these months we are actually unemployed, especially in today's dark economy. Well, that is my story in a nutshell. Thank you for listening. And now Everest will share her story.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee. My name is Everest Morrow. I am the secretary of the Oregon School Employees Association, OSEA. I reside at 2827 Southeast 35th Place in Portland. I join our OSEA president and past president here today in support of Senate Bill 35. My part is to also share with you some of the stories from OSEA members I have submitted as part of my testimony. From Nancy Reynolds in Crook County School District, she says, I wanted to let you know about my summer. There were days when my family barely had enough money to pay our bills, and we even got behind on some. I actually had to go get a food box. With the economy so bad right now, there was no work other than delivering phone books for 20 cents apiece. This work only lasted about 4 weeks at $100 a week. It is not possible to work during the summer when there are no other jobs available. My family has suffered, and I have a really hard time catching up on bills. I was not able to defer any of my bills either. Please seriously consider giving us unemployment. It is greatly needed, and our children are the ones who suffer, especially when we can't buy groceries. Thank you for your time. And from Susan Constant Manzer in Klatskin High School District. For the 23 years I have worked for the Klatskin High School District as a 10-month hourly employee, I have never been able to collect benefits during the summer months when I am literally unemployed. It is nearly impossible to find an employer willing to hire someone who is limited to working for a 2-month period during the summer months only. Classified employees are forced to stretch their 10-month salaries over 12 months. Private sector employees who are contracted out by school districts, such as bus drivers, cooks, or custodians, are allowed to draw unemployment, while the school district employee doing the exact same job with the exact same working conditions is legally prohibited from accessing these benefits. It is arbitrary, unfair, and discriminatory to single out hourly paid school employees from accessing benefits that are made available to everyone else. Please support Senate Bill 35, giving all workers equal rights to unemployment benefits. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Shields. If you have any questions.
Questions? Committee? Senator George.
So I understand, what happens to the benefits package that you have? So you're working for 10 months out of 12 months. Mm-hmm. During those several months, does the school district shut off your medical benefits, or what's the situation there?
Generally, they can be prorated, so you pay for 12 months of insurance in 10 months, because you're taken out of every single check. Or some of them have a provision where they'll pay their portion. Generally, we all have to pay a portion of our own insurance, anywhere from, well, my personal district, it's anywhere from $35 up to $345 a month for our insurance.
It's not true in all districts. I know in our district, people have to pay double it for 3 months to pay for those summer months. So we have people who end up paying the district instead of getting a paycheck. So during the summer, they have nothing.
Is the department coming up?
I believe so, yes. Next. All right. Is that it?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Johnson from the Oregon Employment Department, and why don't we have her come up first? Anybody else from the department? No. And then after that, we'll do. Rob, did you want to testify?
How much time do you have? If you're going long, I'm fine.
Okay. I think we have time for you as long as concision is kept in mind.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, committee members, for the record, my name is Susan Johnson. I'm the acting administrator for the Oregon Employment Department's Unemployment Insurance Division. With me here today is Joy Scott Farmer, and Joy is an operations and policy analyst with the department and an expert in the issue of unemployment insurance as it relates to school employees. I appreciate the opportunity to provide you with some information regarding Senate Bill 35. So Senate Bill 35 amends two statutes, ORS 657221 and ORS 657167, and both relate to unemployment insurance benefits to those employees of educational institutions. Bill removes restrictions that generally prevent non-instructional employees from receiving unemployment insurance benefits between school years or terms and during holiday recess periods. This bill also allows unemployment insurance benefits to part-time instructors at community colleges and state universities between school years or terms by presuming they don't have reasonable assurance of returning to work. Section 1 eliminates language in ORS 657221, which currently denies benefits to non-instructional school employees. This would result in an increase in unemployment insurance benefits paid to these employees. Most of these benefits would be paid from school districts, which reimburse unemployment insurance benefits paid dollar for dollar. We estimate that 18,000 non-instructional employees would draw an average of 14 weeks per year, totaling more than $70 million per year in reimbursable charges to schools. Section 2 of the bill modifies ORS 657167 to allow benefits to part-time instructors at state institutions of higher education and community colleges during periods between academic terms or years. The modification would only apply to instructors in the university system, those instructors as defined by ORS 352002. And the department estimates that 800 employees would receive 13 weeks of benefits per year. The increased cost of paying these part-time instructors is estimated to be more than $4 million per year. Again, payment of these charges would be the responsibility of the educational institutions. Proposed changes to ORS 657167 will place the department out of conformity with federal law. Section 2 states that a part-time instructor is presumed not to have reasonable assurance that he will perform services in a second academic year or term. The federal government defines reasonable assurance, and reasonable assurance means that the individual has a written, oral, or implied agreement that he will perform services in the same or similar type of service in the following year, term, or remainder of a term. It's not a guarantee. To presume part-time instructors don't have reasonable assurance would cause the Employment Department to be out of conformity with the U.S. Department of Labor conformity standards as identified in Section 3304 of FUTA. To be clear, federal law requires a denial of unemployment insurance benefits for professional instructional staff between and within academic terms if the individual has a contract or reasonable assurance of performing the same or similar type of service in the following year, term, or remainder of a term. In addition, this bill would create a different standard for determining between-term status for professional staff from state institutions than it does for other institutions within the state. For example, if the bill were to pass, part-time instructors from the University of Oregon would be eligible for benefits, while those from Willamette University would not. This raises an issue under the equal treatment requirements for government workers under FUTA. If Oregon is found to be out of conformity with federal law, it would lead to the loss of the department's administrative grant of $102 million per biennium. And Oregon employers would pay additional FUTA taxes amounting to $950 million per biennium. This is because subject employers pay a FUTA tax of 6.2% with a 5.4% credit as long as the state conforms with federal law. Employers would lose this credit if we're found to be out of conformity. That concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the snake pit.
Thank you. Nobody had a tax hearing this morning.
Actually, I got a handful, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
I'm just trying to understand the situation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So presently, I guess my understanding is presently the Section 1, and we're talking about the classified employees in school districts, the districts do not pay unemployment insurance now, is that correct?
What happens now is employees from these institutions that do not have a reasonable assurance of returning to work may get unemployment insurance. So all these employers, state employers,
Let me restate my question.
Sure.
School districts.
Yes.
Not universities. The school districts, mm-hmm. Do they presently pay into unemployment insurance just like a regular business does?
No.
Okay.
They only pay unemployment insurance in the event a claim is filed, someone is receiving benefits, and they reimburse for those benefits paid dollar for dollar.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So is that common in all public institutions, or you lost me? Because as a business owner, we pay unemployment insurance, right? We pay the UI into this, so on and so forth, and then they draw, and then later on, sometimes we get quarterly, at least a lot of them lately. So Is this the no, they don't pay in and it's reimbursed dollar for dollar? Is that a common public practice?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, yes, that's the state of Oregon is a reimbursable employer, so they don't pay into the they don't pay taxes as other employers do on a quarterly basis, just you know, in their general payroll. They pay once someone files a claim for unemployment, and then they pay. It's not generalized from the pool; they just pay dollar for dollar.
Whoa. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
This is educational.
You're looking for a new line of business, huh?
Boy, let me tell you. And the statement was made by earlier that, that teachers can draw unemployment during the summertime. Is that correct, too?
Senator Shields, or excuse me, Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, they can as long as they do not have a reasonable assurance to return to work.
So overall,
no. Not necessarily. So a teacher who has absolutely no reasonable assurance, a teacher who may have been fired from the job and has no reasonable assurance to go to work for any other educational institution, that person would be eligible for unemployment.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, you lost me here, because if he was fired in the private sector, they couldn't go draw insurance if it was found for cause. So you lost me here. Please respond.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that depends. You know, if you're fired, it's a whole other issue, and we would determine whether or not it was misconduct connected with your work. So assuming that there was no misconduct connected with your work, or you could use the situation of just the job was eliminated because of budget cuts, just ended, and then that person would be entitled to unemployment benefits.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Okay, one more, and then we're going to move on, because I don't think we're going to be moving this today.
I got that one. This is educational, Mr. Chair. So last question, Mr. Chair. So then, if budget cuts and the teacher were laid off at the end of the year, you're saying that in the state of Oregon, when they filed for unemployment insurance, that then the district would be billed back for that amount. So in there, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes, that is correct. And, you know, I'm happy to meet with you anytime and bring my expert person, Joy, with me to talk to you about school employee issues. It is interesting and kind of complex.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have lots of discussions with the director and the
Senator George.
Okay, so I didn't get at first that. So if you know you're not going to come back, you can get unemployment insurance.
Dollar for dollar.
And under the system right now, it's a dollar for dollar repayment back. So in essence, it's going to cost the school district exactly the same to have somebody go through the unemployment insurance, get insurance benefits, and then the school district pays UI back. Than if they just negotiated through collective bargaining an extension of some additional pay during the 2 month time. I mean, it's in essence the same exact thing, except rather than going through the, I mean, you're seeing shaking heads, so maybe that's something I need to ask another witness. But it looks like to me that if you're going to give somebody $1,000 for those 2 months, if you bill it through unemployment, the school district would in turn just pay unemployment $1,000. It's a dollar for dollar situation. So in essence, all we're doing is bogging down unemployment insurance by doing it this way rather than through collective bargaining.
Mr. Chair, Senator George,
can you understand what you're getting at? Is there a way that the school district
would
pay less?
So that's true.
Are we cost shifting to the private sector?
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm not familiar with the law, but perhaps, you know, the school district could have some other system in which they reimbursed or gave school employees some sort of a benefit during the summer recess or holiday period.
A stipend equal to unemployment benefits. Okay, thank you. I think probably another witness is who I need to ask that question.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Rob, if you want to come up, you're more than welcome. Okay. Please identify yourself.
Sure. Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon, along with our counterparts with the Oregon School Employees Association. We are AFT in Oregon with 33,000 members. I just wanted to correct a couple things. First of all, regarding UI, we also have members in K-12 districts, and we are not oblivious to the fiscal reality right now in the state and looking at these big fiscals. We contest some of the numbers that are coming out of the Employment Department and would certainly like to sit down and talk about how we can come to terms with those numbers. I will say that we have data from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and 9% of K-12 classified employees have either lost their jobs or their positions have been eliminated over the last 2 years because of budget declines in the state. So this is something that our members are facing constantly. Looking at summer as an issue, and we'd enjoy an opportunity to sit down at a future date to see if we can work something out with employment. Regarding Section 2 of the bill around reasonable assurance, I did want to correct that the states of Washington and California both have statutory definitions that are different to the state of Oregon, and that adjunct faculty sign a form saying they do not have a job coming back, and that there's been a California Supreme Court case that I can get to the committee for your review. And also, there's a conversation happening with Representative Dembro on the House side in the Subcommittee on Higher Education around this issue, looking at both reasonable assurance and also the nature of our community colleges being 12-month institutions and not 9-month institutions, to look at unemployment insurance. Because what we have right now is we have a lot of adjunct faculty that teach every single summer section, and they teach them routinely, and then through what we consider a glitch in the law, if they lose their summer sections, they come back and file for unemployment insurance, and they're treated like K-12 teachers, and it's considered a summer shutdown period. So Representative Dembro is looking into this issue, and I know he's been working with the Employment Department during the interim, and look forward to Ms. Johnson's continuing conversation on that front. So,
one question, then we're going to move on.
Yeah. I'm still having a hard time, because it sounds like to me, from the Unemployment Department, is this a dollar-for-dollar reimbursement that the public agency gives to the Unemployment Department? And I keep seeing shaking heads, so I'm going to add, I want somebody, but maybe I'm hoping you know this answer. If it's dollar-for-dollar, then why not do it through salary? And if it's not dollar-for-dollar, then this is a cost shift to the private sector. So it's either one or the other. It's either a cost shift to the private sector, which means private employers will be carrying the weight, or it's a dollar-for-dollar shift, which seems like to me you could take care of with salary.
Well, Chair Shields, Senator George, I think it definitely is a conversation to get some clarity on this with the Employment Department. You raised some very good questions. I think concerning contingent faculty, it's a little bit of a different scenario, because you could be a faculty member that's teaching, loses your sections in the spring term, is able to file for UI, hits summer term, your UI payments are cut off because of the definition of reasonable assurance, and then they start up again in the fall. So the total time frame that you're able to draw unemployment insurance could be exactly the same, and that's why we have some real issues over the definition. So, but I know that you're time limited with the number of bills that you have. Be glad to meet with the Employment Department, with individual members, to sit down and see if we can gain some clarity on this issue.
Good. I think we do need some more discussion moving forward on this bill. So I will use the prerogative of the chair and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 35 and open public hearing on Senate Bill 292. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 292 prohibits imposing a financial obligation on a consumer who accepts a free offer unless the offer complies with the disclosure and billing requirements within the measure. It requires the consumer's affirmative consent to the terms of the free offer. It would designate violations of the measure as an unlawful trade practice, and there is an emergency clause on this measure, so it would take effect upon passage. I believe for the original measure, Mr. Chair, we have a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement.
Mr. Okay. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
I was going to ask you if it would be all right if I made a few preliminary comments.
Absolutely.
Since I've been working on this for a long time. Thank
yes.
you, Mr. Chair. And do you mind if I do that from here, or do you want me to go down in the hot seat?
Whatever your preference.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, this is in committee. This is an issue that I started working on quite a long time ago as the former chair of the committee, formerly known as Consumer Protection. And there was a work group that was put together that consisted of many people from the Attorney General's Office, the consumer groups, many different telecommunications cable companies, and several representatives of the Direct Marketing Association, including one who flew in from the East Coast for our meeting. So we had a lot of people around the table. But I wanted to tell the committee about some of the problems and what we're trying to address with this issue. 2009, the Better Business Bureau said that free trials were at the top of their list of complaints. And this has to do with offers to lose weight or get rid of wrinkles or brighten your smile or improve your memory. And there have been a lot of there have been a lot of offers that are made, and they're made on the radio, they're made online, and I took it upon myself to check into some of these just to figure out what the business model was, and so I just wanted to tell the committee just a little bit about some of the calls that I made to the toll-free numbers. There was a skin cream that there was so much demand for this product, but I, when I called in, was given congratulations by recording because I called in time to get one of the risk-free trials. There was so much demand that they were almost out of the trial, so they gave me a reservation code and put me on hold, but because there was so much demand, I was never given a person to talk to. There was a recording where they asked for my name, my address, my zip code, and my credit card number, and I was very concerned about that because I was given the opportunity to give my credit card number to purchase this product that would have made me look much younger, but without the opportunity to ask any questions. And I tried a couple of different toll-free numbers and occasionally got a live person, but often did not. There was a night skin cream that was going to bring new vitality, and many people who use it noticed results in the first few days. And that ended up at being $69.95 per month if the consumer was not given the opportunity to cancel. And the consumers, if they can reach a live person, are told that they need their credit card number so that they can pay for shipping and handling. There was a memory pill offer that you had to call in the next 10 minutes to qualify for the risk-free trial.
And you should forget the number.
Yeah, right, then you forget the number. And again, it was a recording. I was lucky, though, because I called in time to get one of the last free trials. They were almost out, I was told. I was given a code, and again, I got a recording where I was asked to give my name, my address, and my credit card number. So this caused me a lot of concern, Mr. Chair, and we heard from consumers through the consumer groups and from the Attorney General's office about some of these. A quick little Google search, I found several people. There tend to be some markets where this happens, but there was one that I found where one particular company had more than 100 different names and products that it was marketing through free trial offers. So what this bill does, Mr. Chair and Committee, is that it prohibits a financial obligation on a consumer unless they're given information about the offer prior to the time that they accept. So it doesn't end free trial offers. We didn't want to do that. I think there's a place for them, but I believe, and I believe the work group came to this consensus, that the consumer's entitled to find out what they're getting and how much it's going to cost and how to cancel before they become financially obligated. It also addresses the issue of getting an ancillary product, not one that was part of the free trial offer. That happens, and I believe Karen Garst is going to talk about that with her son's experience, that the person thinks they're getting the trial of the product, like the tooth whitener or the memory pill, and then they're being billed for something like a health magazine or financial services that they weren't expecting. It's either in the tiny print, fine print, or not disclosed at all. So this, again, it prevents the financial obligation unless they've obtained consent for that additional product and they get the information ahead of time. There was a federal bill that was passed after we began our conversation here at the state that deals with only online transactions. This bill deals with all the free trial offers in the same way, but it's consistent with the federal bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me explain the history of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici. I had a very good experience with the hair growth company offered free trials.
That's why you support Trevor.
Oh, and one more comment, Mr. Chair. This bill is not ready to move. There is an amendment request pending with legislative counsel from just a few language changes that the Department of Justice determined were necessary, and I believe Keith could address those if there's questions about them, but we don't have the amendment yet.
Okay, good. Well, we've got three people signed up to testify. Can we have Karen Garst come forward, please?
Debbie, you want to set this up? Chairman Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, my name is Karen Garst. I can happy to say I'm retired and no longer lobbying full-time. What I wanted to do today is give you a view of how this happens. And she'll be setting up the PowerPoint. And then I have some comments specifically on the bill. And I want to acknowledge Senator Bonamici for getting the work group together. I participated briefly in that, but for really calling it to the committee's attention.
And while we're waiting, Karen, you're just representing yourself, or are you representing...
Myself and my son.
Good.
No, retired. But about 30 years ago, I worked for the American Federation of Teachers in Oregon and dealt with some of the unemployment compensation issues you heard earlier in a bill, and it was deja vu all over again.
Karen's also the former executive director of the Oregon State Bar Association.
There we go.
Which is why some of us recognize her wearing a different hat.
And for those of you who saw the presentation during the interim, I've shortened it considerably. So there we go.
And those of you who haven't, you will never make Karen mad at you.
Well, here's the victim. This is my son, Samuel Dakota Garst. And you can see with teeth like that why, as a sophomore in college, he has to keep them white. I got a call from him about 11 o'clock.
Could we have the lights dimmed?
It's hard to see over there. Thank you.
I had a call from him about 11 o'clock one night. Of course, I was sound asleep. And he said, Mom, there's an $80 charge on my credit card. And I said, okay, well, I can look at that tomorrow, but probably not tonight. But thank you for letting me know. How this often starts, and this is very, very clever marketing. This looks like a neutral review. Well, it's not. It's part of their marketing. All of these products you see here, this Akai Berry, I don't even know what that is, Dazzle White Pro, all of these things, this looks like Web for Health. Well, this is a medical review saying these things are great, right? Well, it's not. It's part of the marketing ploy. And they often use, as seen on NBC, CBS, it looks like that those are endorsing it. Well, not. They just simply purchased advertising, or not, as the case may be. They were using Oprah Winfrey's name in one of these, and I know there's a lawsuit pending that she has brought for using her name inappropriately. And, of course, similar young people are doing the same thing, so join the crowd. You don't want to be left behind. And as Senator Bonamici said, click here to see if you can too. Maybe not. Maybe there's not enough room for you. And then you have these claim your trials. Now, you know, pretty good advertising. And, of course, when you click on that, you do qualify for the trial. Even though it's limited, everybody seems to qualify. Now, here are the terms and conditions. Now, I don't know how many of you, when you're in a hotel and get wireless access, read the terms and conditions before you check the box, terms and conditions, okay, I agree. I've never read them. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this fine print at the top you see. But this is the way it's laid out. It's $4.95, $2.95 for shipping and handling. And, of course, you have to pay that through a credit card because this particular transaction is all online. But I can assure you no 18-year-old or probably 25-year-old is going to read the fine print. And I'm not sure I would have either. Now, this is what the fine print says. You see the bold. If you choose to keep your trial, your active credit card will be billed at a low member price of only $87.62 for your trial, and then again every 30 days. Obviously, my son didn't see that. And then, as Senator Bonamici was saying later, you will also receive trial subscription to World, I think that's supposed to be Club Fitness, typo there. You'll be billed $24 a month. So you could possibly incur $100 a month and for this trial. Now, what happens to most people, because I've been on a lot of blogs on the who are people who are concerned about this and complained, they never notice it. They don't notice it on their credit card. It goes for 2 or 3 months. So most of the people, before they even notice it, they've incurred several hundred dollars. And my son pays a little more attention and noticed it right away. So here's the problems we encountered. On his credit card statement, where he noticed this, there was a phone number. He tried the phone number. He never got an answer. And then I told him to check with Wells Fargo, where he had the account, and the fraud division said, have you recently had a small charge on your credit card? Maybe you purchased a product? And then, you know, the light goes off, and my son says, oh, yeah, I purchased some tooth whitening from Dazzle Smile. And he said, well, check out the website. So then he went to the website, and sure enough, when he was really careful, he read that they were going to charge his account. So then he turned it over to Mom. And so I went to the website, and they had this web chat thing that I went through. And first of all, you know, they didn't know him. They didn't know his address. They had never heard of him. And I kept on insisting. And finally, lo and behold, they found it. They would cancel the trial, but they wouldn't do the refund. So I would say, you know, probably 80-90% of people would have stopped there and said, okay, well, at least I stopped it. I'm out $80 or whatever. Of course, not me.
I just want to point out, Mr. Chair, that in committee, that as Karen showed you, the free trial actually costs $87. If you don't return it, if you don't cancel it, you get billed $87 for the free trial.
And the return time is 14 days. So by the time you get the product, and you use it, the 14 days are gone. So I then called customer service, and the person, of course, didn't want anything to do with me. I said, please let me talk to the supervisor. I talked to the supervisor, and finally she agreed to refund that money, that $80 or so, if the product was returned. And she said, you should probably get a tracking number for the product, hint, hint. So she knew what the company was going to do. So I had my son return the product, waited, you know, 4-6 weeks, no refund. So I called again, and I said, gee, didn't get the refund back. And she said, the person said, well, we didn't get the product. Do you have a tracking number? So I called my son, got the tracking number, called back. I said, here's the tracking number. Oh, we did find it. And so they were going to do the refund, but she said, oh, I can't push the credit card through. So I didn't get the refund initially from the company. When I called Wells Fargo again, the fraud division, they refunded it because we'd returned the product. Then, of course, they got me mad. So that's not a good thing. I filed a complaint with the Consumer Protection of Oregon. They were very good. They did write to the attorney, who I eventually got a refund from the company. But I always believe that it's not just me, it's all the other people who are affected. So I wrote to every single state, Attorney General's Consumer Protection, with a great deal of material that I had researched about this issue. I wrote to the FTC, et cetera. There were a couple of states who were pursuing the issue, and we shared information for a while. I found that the federal government was going to do something about it. I have a few comments on the bill, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions. This is a millions of dollars scam. There's a person in Canada called Jesse Willems who's marketing all of these kind of things. He sets it up for people. He's making millions and millions of dollars off this. It doesn't matter to him if the trial is canceled because he's already made $200 or $300 on all of these people. Will this bill in Oregon stop him? Probably not. Will the state's consumer protection agencies, oh, that should be S apostrophe, be willing to prosecute? I don't know. I didn't see. I had most of the people said, we'll put it in the file. They've got a lot of issues on their plate. I'm not sure whether somebody losing $80 is top of the list to try to get them all together, to try to do class action. It's very difficult. And how do you deal with scammers that change names and websites constantly? This changed in the 2 months I was pursuing this. It changed at least twice, and the product was being marketed on multiple sites. What they do is they get somebody willing to ship out the product, they do all the marketing, and they just change the website. So trying to track it down and follow it is very difficult. I think this bill is a good first step, but I don't think if you're not going to prosecute anybody, you'll get rid of the worst offenders. And if this doesn't work, I really think you need to change the law about negative opt-out trials. Now, have I engaged in negative opt-out trials since this? I have. My husband told me I was crazy. But I went on Ancestry.com. I'm doing my genealogy. They had one. They were very upfront about it. I wrote down all the information. I printed all the pages. And after 3 months, they reminded me that, you know, now, you know, we have your credit card information. Do you want to continue it, et cetera? But I don't, I think the world would be okay without negative opt-out trials. If you really want to give something to free and you've got a good product, then give a free trial and remind the person and have them do it. The vast majority of this, I think with the way you've taken care of the other people's concerns, such as telephone, et cetera, is to scam people out of money for a month or two. So that concludes my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing that forward. I know the easy thing to do would just be to cut your losses and move on. I appreciate you standing up for the rest of Oregon's consumers who are being taken.
Any questions?
All right. Thank you very much, Karen, for your testimony. We appreciate it. Could Keith Dabanovich and John Bartholomew come up, and then after that, Rebecca Roth.
You go first, Keith.
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I am Chief of Staff to Attorney General Kroger. Let me start by saying that free trial offers are not all bad. They can be very good marketing tools and advantageous to consumers. The challenge is when there are hidden terms or, as we've just heard, difficulty in the ability to cancel the transaction. The complaint that we're talking about here is something that is quite frequent that we received in the Attorney General's consumer complaint database. We code the complaints based upon the way that people call them into us, so it's kind of difficult sometimes to get a precise number of how many complaints we get. But I can say that in 2010 alone, we've had at least 150 consumer complaints dealing with this issue. Now, we have a consumer educator that travels the state, and she goes to every corner. She's meeting with young and old, rich and poor, and urban and rural people. And this is one of the top three complaints that she gets time and time again. It is a problem, and people are getting suckered into free trial offers and not really having an understanding of what they're really signing up for. Now, many of these complaints stem from people signing up for something perfectly legitimate online and fully anticipating that they're going to pay for a product. But what happens is, as you go through the checkout procedure online, there are boxes that are already checked in which you're consenting to additional services and what's called data pass. The legitimate retailer will take your credit card address and credit card number and your address and pass it on to a company that then will represent to you, gee whiz, wouldn't you like a free magazine subscription for a month? And you go, yeah, sure, why not? But what you don't understand frequently is that that company now has your credit card information, and it's a separate company, so to speak, and they will now start billing you for the magazine that you thought was going to be free. And so when the bill comes in, there's a line item for something that you had no idea that you ordered because you frankly didn't think that you did order it. What you had ordered, for example, is you had signed up for a good or a service, a product, something that you had ordered from a legitimate retailer, and they passed on your data to somebody that was trying to sell you something that you didn't want. One of the problems that we often see is that months after you get the credit card statement and you start looking at it, you start to realize, that's not what I want. I'm going to go ahead and cancel. Well, as Ms. Garnt said, it's sometimes easier said than done. Exhibit A to my testimony is involving a company called Pain Vanish. And as an aging athlete, I can tell you if this stuff worked, I'd be buying it by the case. But if you look through these marketing materials, which were sent not online but through the mail, you have to go to page 6 before you see in really small print what you're actually signing up for. And in this case, they're going to send you a free sample, and then unless you cancel, they'll send you another sample at $14.99, and then they'll send you more product at $24.99 until you cancel. Well, let's assume that you, after a couple of months, either had enough Pain Vanish cream or just don't want it anymore. The ability to cancel is obviously very important. Now, if you look very carefully, there's nothing in this advertisement that tells you how you can cancel. Nothing. There's no telephone number. There's no web address. There's nothing that indicates how you cancel. And indeed, this company alone in 2009 generated 11 complaints to our office. So instead of relieving the consumer's pain, in this particular company, they caused a lot of consumer pain and anguish when they kept getting a product they didn't want and were trying to cancel. Now, these cancellation problems include when the package comes, there's no return address. And so you sample the product, it doesn't work, you don't like it, and you think all you got to do is send it back and they'll give your money back. Except there's no return address on the materials that they sent you. We've had phone numbers that when you call, they are temporarily disconnected, but it sure seems like it's on a permanent basis because consumers have called over the course of a couple of weeks, and that telephone number that you're supposed to call to cancel is temporarily disconnected. We've had customer service representatives who answer the phone to take your order, but when you call that number and ask to cancel, they say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not authorized to cancel." You have to do that online. So the consumer goes to the website and tries to do it online, and they kept getting kicked off the website. And in essence, they were never able to cancel. And we've heard of stories of people calling in and attempting to cancel by phone, and they've been put on hold for 10 minutes, and after 10 minutes, they're rolled over to voicemail, and then the voicemail box is, guess what, it's full. So in essence, you can't cancel. As Senator Bonamici indicated, this legislation is a product of extensive meetings of work groups and a number of drafts that were circulated in an effort to reach consensus, and I think we've reached that. The key benefits of this legislation are the disclosures that come with the legislation that are now required for anybody that does marketing in Oregon. And that is so that the consumer knows what it's actually going to cost them when they purchase something or they think they're going to get something for free. Second, it tells the consumer how they can cancel, which is critically important. And it levels the playing field by requiring that the vendor or the retailer allow you to cancel using the same methodology that you signed up. It makes sense. If you called on the phone, you should be able to cancel on the phone. And last but not least, it eliminates data pass. I mentioned to you buying a product legitimately online and then having your data, your credit card data and address passed off to a company that tries to ship you something for free. This bill eliminates the data pass unless the consumer affirmatively consents to that data pass. Now, there are circumstances that you may very well want the free trial offer or the new magazine, but you should have the option on whether you want it or not. It shouldn't be required that you opt out of it. And this bill prohibits the data pass unless the consumer consents to it. As Senator Bonamici indicated, there is some federal legislation which was passed last year. It however, only deals with internet sales. And some of the examples we've talked about, including the materials that I've provided the committee, these marketing attempts occur by phone and as well by mail. And so this legislation addresses both of those as opposed to the federal legislation, which only addresses online marketing. The second thing that the federal act does is it only deals with negative option marketing. The state bill, Senate Bill 292, addresses all kinds of free or free trial marketing attempts. And it sets out what terms are material to a consumer, whereas the federal legislation is still somewhat vague and broad. And last but not least, it enables there to be an enforcement mechanism for the Department of Justice, whereas the federal legislation doesn't provide really any strong enforcement mechanisms at all. In our view, this legislation clarifies current state law, it fills a gap in our state law, and it provides clear and specific laws which are a lot easier for us to enforce. And therefore, we in the Department of Justice support Senate Bill 292.
Okay. Thank you, Keith. John.
All right. Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a policy advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. We are a statewide consumer group that with over 10,000 members across the state. And a lot of what I would say has already been said today, so I'll be very brief. I did email Mr. Brennan some testimony that you should have, some written testimony. I just want to go on the record saying that OSPIRG, as a consumer group, is in full support of Senate Bill 292. Millions of Americans have lost billions of dollars from these particular free trial offers that we've been discussing today. And as Senator Bonamici noted when she did the introduction, the Better Business Bureau of the United States called this the number one consumer fraud in America in 2009. There was also a congressional report that noted that just three companies generated over $1.4 billion in revenue by employing tactics that caused millions of consumers to unknowingly enroll in and be charged for their membership programs. And, of course, as we noticed, consumers are having a hard time getting out of these programs once they're in. I did a little blog post about this last week, put it on Facebook, and very quickly we had a comment from just one of our fans on Facebook saying, her name is Crystal Meehan. She wrote, regarding teeth whitening, a teeth whitening product, quote, I logged hours on the phone to various customer service numbers and never did get a full refund, even though they charged me before their trial period even ended. So it's one of these things that's very it's all over the place. Consumers here in Oregon are being affected. And that highlights one of the three issues we're concerned with. There's the difficult cancellation. We've already covered that. The lack of clear and conspicuous notice when you're signing up for these offers as to what you're actually getting yourself into, oftentimes is buried in some kind of legal disclaimer. And, of course, this issue of sharing of the credit card numbers, the data pass issue. Now, the Restore Online Shoppers Confidence Act, which is the federal legislation that was passed and signed into law in December, it does provide, it does address some of these issues, but as has already been noted, it only deals with online purchases, and people are getting mailers, people are getting phone calls to their homes, people are getting magazines with these ads in, there's radio ads, television ads, and what Senate Bill 292 does is that it covers all of these things so that consumers will be protected, they will have all the information they need to make wise decisions in the marketplace. It's very common sense legislation. It does not ban free trial offers at all. It just makes sure that offers are made legitimately and consumers have all the information they need and they can find out how to get out of these offers if they want to. So I want to thank Senator Bonamici for taking the lead on this issue and thank the committee for the opportunity to support Senate Bill 292. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Questions?
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to acknowledge everyone who participated in the work group, especially Ron Barnes from the Direct Marketing Association, who flew out a couple of times. His participation was really helpful. And then I also wanted to let the committee know that I did receive an email from Jim Craven from Tech America, who was also on the work group, that he didn't have any problems with the bill.
Thank you. They must have the whitest teeth. all right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Rebecca Roth, please. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. I've never done this before, so I hope I address you correctly, committee members. I'm here because...
Ms. Roth, can you, just as a formality, identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Rebecca Roth. Thank you.
Thanks.
And I live in Salem, Oregon. And I'm here because I've been concerned about our government, and everything that's being talked about in this bill seems to apply not only to the private sector, but to government. And we often are presented with ideas that seem so agreeable up front, and then they end up costing taxpayers a ton of money, and we can't get out of it. And the presentation that is made to taxpayers right now about the health care bill, I mean the health care, Oregon health care program, is that you see it on all the billboards, you see it on the buses, you see it in the advertisements, and it's going to mean that if it passes, that there's going to be a lot more people signing up, which is going to cost taxpayers a lot more money, which we can't get out of. There's no way to get out of these programs, it seems like, once they get started. And today, I don't sit in very many committee meetings, but it seems like most of the people speaking here are people who belong to government. And so it seems like the people that are speaking to you are government people who are advocating for programs. I'm speaking in generalities now because I don't sit in on many committee meetings. But I just would like to appeal to you to understand that these programs that you put in place government-wise, just let me give an example. Our schools. Oregon is pretty low in the nation on our school performance, and we continually want to throw more money at it. Who's here today talking about teachers getting all the money that they deserve? I didn't see any taxpayers here. I saw union people here. So we need to think about the people that are paying the bills before we present all of our ideas, like what you're talking about in this bill. It's not just the private companies that are doing this. It's government that's doing it too. Let's see. Another one that I thought of is that when the tax bill comes due. Like, my husband and I are self-employed, and when the tax bill comes due, that's the first thing that has to get paid. It's the thing that, if we don't pay it, we're going to have somebody show up at our house and maybe go to tax prison or, you know, get terrible things happen to us. So that's like the thing we have to focus on, whether we want that program or not. And I'm here to appeal to you. The government is broke. And we need to stop a lot of the things we're doing. And I'm not very good at saying that, but I've said it. Thank you.
You did just fine. Thank you very much. And we really do appreciate you coming forward to bring that to us. Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
So if we apply this to PERS, PEB, and everything, do you think that'd make it any more controversial? Because it seemed like a really free trial offer back in the 70s when they put it into place. So.
Fair enough. All right. Any other questions, comments? We really appreciate you coming, Ms. Roth. This is your legislature, and we're here to address your concerns. Sometimes we do that better than other days, but we really do appreciate you coming to bring your point of view forward. Colleagues, this committee meeting is adjourned.